of the most serious crises in the history of France. In this edition of Spotlight, we will take a look at how these challenges have been testing the French government's commitment to human rights and how, to save his pension reform bill, Macron has lost France. To discuss that, we are joined by Mustapha Traoré, academic and political commentator who's joining us from Paris. And Don DeVar, activist and commentator, joining us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen. Let's begin with Mr. Traoré. Now, over the last week in particular, we've seen protests breaking out almost every day, more than a million people taking part in these protests. And still Macron is insisting on following through with this pensions reform. Why is that?
I think there are different reasons to explain his position and his decision. He's now in his second mandate, so he knows that he won't be elected anymore. So this is his last years as the French president, and he's got his political views, his political plans, and now is the best moment for him to put into practice, to implement all the laws, all the decisions he wants for France. Of course, many people are disappointed. Many people do not approve of the reform, especially because with this reform, the pension, the retirement age is going to be pushed to 64 instead of 62. And so it means two more years. And this is, of course, for when you started work at a very young age. But for those who started quite late, those who, for example, went to university and entered working life quite late, for them it's going to be 67. So he knows that now is the moment, and this is why he used this thing which is part of the French constitution, the 49.3. So it is thanks to the 49.3, so which means that there were no debate. There was no debate in parliament. They did not vote. The MPs, the French MPs, did not vote. He just passed the law. And he is doing and putting into place the policies of those who elected him. Those who elected him, those who put him in power. This is my opinion.
Well, thank you very much for that. Let's bring in Mr. Don DeBar from New York. Thank you very much, sir, for joining us. Now, two-thirds of the French oppose this law, and the approval rating of Macron is now at around 28%. It's really a dismal popularity rate, actually. And, of course, France is one of those countries that prides itself as a role model of democracy. Democracy, as we say, the government of the people, by the people, for the people. And it seems that Macron is not even listening to these people.
Well, it's been interesting listening to Macron speak now after listening to him lecture Iran and places all over the world on how to treat protesters. And we're hearing, I don't know what the reports are on the ground, but I'm hearing from news agencies and people that I know in Paris that, in fact, some of the police and fire officials have joined the protesters at this point. You know, if you look at the historical context here, I don't know if you want to go back to 1789, to the actual French Revolution, to the Paris Commune in 1871, or to Paris in 1968. And we're talking, these have always been really important in revolutionary history in the world. The terms right and left, for example, applied to politics come out of the French Revolution in 1789. The historical context has always revolved around class issues, you know, create these divisions, basically the society is not providing for large sectors of the population who are being more and more immiserated. That produces these outcomes. Now, the particular thing here with the pensions is only, you know, one of a number of things that have happened over the last 40 years with the pauperization of working people across Europe, with the austerity and the removal of the safety nets, etc. Looking across the globe, for example, Russia and China, those two horrible places for people to live. The retirement age is 55 for women and 60 for men. Somehow they managed to provide that. Here in the United States even, I took retirement on Social Security at 62. French people have had, certainly since the 70s, a halfway decent and comparable situation, and it's one of the last things that have remained out of the, various things that were fought for and won over the last 150, 200 years. Macron is now taking that away. And the fact that it's happening in his second term and he's bypassing the legislature to do it should be a lesson to people looking at a second term for Joe Biden here in the United States, by the way.
Thank you very much. Now, Mr. Tarore, Celia Billain, who runs the Paris office of the European Council on Foreign Relations, which is a think tank, says that there is a feeling that the president is not listening to his people at this moment, and the political legitimacy of Macron's second mandate is being called into question. What is your opinion?
Yes, I think this is perfectly right, but I think this is not new. There's nothing new in it. We know that President Macron never listened to the people. We saw it with the Yellow Vest movements 3 or 4 years ago, just before the COVID-19 crisis. So it is not something new. We know that he's there, and this is why he was elected. This is why some decided to have him in power. They prepared him as a candidate because they knew that with him, he was the only person who could, shape the French nation as they wanted to. And this is now we've got to. But it is something that the French people also accepted. They had the choice. They had the choice, even if many people say they did not have the choice. It was between Marine Le Pen and him. When I say he had the choice, I mean that there was a first round of the presidential elections. There, in the French presidential election, there was a first round. They did not pick up the right candidates. So now they have to accept it.
So, Mr. DeBar, you did, of course, mention that Macron has been lecturing here and there other countries regarding the issue of human rights. Now France itself is actually using excessive force against these protesters who are mainly peaceful protesters. There are not that many reports of violence as far as the protests are concerned. And this actually raises a lot of question marks here, especially when we go back just a couple of months when Macron even held a meeting with people who were supporting the riots in Iran. He actually held a meeting, an official meeting, with these people who have no legitimacy and do not represent any Iranian group or party or political faction or any kind of group, as you can say. What is your opinion regarding that?
Yeah, there's no mass constituency for that at all. This is, you have these attempted color revolutions that take place from time to time. You had a pair of them in Iran. I think it was 2009 was the earlier one. We had one in 5 years ago, for example, in Nicaragua. There was an attempted one there. There was one in Cuba over the last few years. And let's go back to the image of John McCain and Victoria Nuland and a host of other actual American government officials standing in front of a mob that was killing police officers and burning down buildings and exhorting them on to further, actually, ultimately, to overthrowing the government, with the demands from the outside that those people respect the rights of the protesters. This, you know, Macron was one of those voices, and his, and the members of his party, Sarkozy and others over the whatever period you want to talk about. That, let's talk also about what happened in Libya and what they tried to do in Syria. Well, you know, this is something that's a common problem. And then finally, all right, in May of 2018, I marched with the yellow vests in Paris. And, you know, there were maybe 100,000 people that were out there. They were been mobilizing for years. Again, the context is a gradually intensifying over a period of almost 4.5 decades now, austerity and increasing poverty and powerlessness that's been exacerbated over the last year and a half, by the way, by the consequences of war in Ukraine that has both austerity because of the need to fund NATO and buy weapons and such, but also the fallout in terms of inflation and fuel prices and fertilizers and food and everything else. The people on the ground are hurting, and their governments are not responding. And what happened? That's basically when the powers who are governing can no longer govern in the old ways, and the people will not be governed in the old ways. They call that a revolutionary condition. And I'm looking at the history of France, and I'm looking at the fact that there was a problem over the condition of the people in 1789. There was a problem with the way that the military felt they were being treated in 1871. And then you had an illegal war in Vietnam that was being protested and the response against protesters in 1968. You have all of those things operating now and not much room to blow air back into the system. So this could be really catch fire. And these conditions exist across Europe now as well.
And do you believe that from now on Macron can actually ever talk about democracy, ever, particularly on the international scale?
Well, not credibly. When people have no shame, they'll do anything, okay? And, you know, the Western political class has demonstrated over and over that they have no shame. But I don't know who would accept a lecture from him. Certainly no one in China, Russia, Iran, you know, and by the way, now Saudi Arabia as well, and around the world, that the territory that exists for the exclusion zone for the United States to banish people from has shrunken almost to the size of the United States at this point. There's a new world being born. It's actually being midwifed by the United States by forcing the rest of the world to do this.
Well, we will get back to that new world order that you just pointed out. But let's ask this question from Mr. Taroe now. Macron's legitimacy outside France is suffering as well. Our other guest from New York, Mr. Don DeBar, did point to a few issues. And also on Friday, a long-planned state visit to France by Britain's King Charles III was also postponed.
Yes, yes, of course. And I think it is a good thing for some African countries that are trying to emancipate themselves from the chains of France. Like I am thinking here of countries like Mali and Burkina Faso, because now Macron is in a weaker position. France won't be able to lecture them on some issues in Mali. So I think this is a good point for the emancipation of some African countries. So, in fact, what I think is that maybe Macron was a good president for the Africans because it is during his presidency that many countries are going, African countries have the possibility to set free from the French chains. So that's the positive thing, maybe.
Mr. Traoré, Macron himself claims that this was the ground of why he was re-elected. How do you think Macron will go down in history?
he will be seen as a liberal, and he came to shape France. He was the only candidate who was able to do it, to stand the pressure of the people, and this is why he was elected. I think that when you look at the French society, if you want to have an idea about what the French society is going to be like in 10 years or 20 years' time, you just have to look at the United States or Britain. Very liberal. And there's no way we can escape this one. I know it's not good, but there's no way we can escape this one. And the disappointing thing is that it seems that the French people have not realized it. If they had realized it earlier, they would have been better prepared. But now I think it's too late. I think the time to change things was when they had the Yellow Vest movement. It seems that this organization was not really respected. It was maybe because of the media as well. But the thing is that they missed the train.
So, Mr. Dondebar, I would also like to have your response to this question as well, particularly in the light of what you just mentioned as a new world order emerging. How do you think France will be remembered in this new world order where the Western countries, Europe and the United States in particular, do not have the final say anymore?
Well, people are beginning to speak. I've noticed this over the last month or so. Not just about the rise of the multipolar world and the new order, but they're looking also at the close of the colonial period that's lasted about 500 years, centered in Europe and the last 100 years or so also in North America. From that context, you're looking again at sort of losing the domination of Western political thinking. I had mentioned earlier at the French Revolution, the terms left and right, for example, first were applied to politics. Members of the National Assembly that sat to the left of the presiding chair of this assembly were supporters of the revolution, opponents of the king, and the king's supporters sat to the right. People have been grappling with the question of right and left right now since the fall of the Soviet Union, but particularly in the last couple of years, because so many of the issues that were identified with one side or the other in Western politics don't fit the current conditions. You have people that are against globalization and for example, war on Russia and China. Many of them identify as being of the right. And those who are opposed to the global corporate economic behemoth also do so, many of them, from a perspective almost of Adam Smith rather than the various interpretations of Karl Marx. And so the whole period seems to be coming to an end, and a new world born, not just multipolar with respect to the traditional last period since World War II, but also truly post-colonial, where the centers of power rest with the people on the ground globally.
So, Mr. Traore, back to the issue of this whole pension reforms bill. You're still waiting in France for the Constitutional Council to pass this bill before it becomes law. How do you expect this to unfold?
I think that it's going to pass for me. I do not see it being rejected. So I think that for me, it's nice to demonstrate, it's not nice to protest, but I'm very skeptical about what's going to happen next. I think that it's too late. It's too late, unfortunately. And it is his second mandate. He's got no reason to step back. There's no reason for Macron to. He's got nothing to lose. So this is what we have to understand. The protest and the reason why people are demonstrating is just for it not to happen again. But this time, it is too late. And I think that in a few weeks' time, you will have people who are going to, because business has to go on. Okay, you work, and if you do not work, you won't be paid. You have lots of people who are employees. Some have their businesses. So I do not see it is too late. There's nothing we can do. It is past now. We have to be very vigilant for next time, because we know that today it's we have 2 years added to the retirement age, but we know that maybe in 5 years' time we might have one more year and one more year. Like people from my generation, I know that by the time I get to 67, the law would change and they would ask me to go to 70 years old to retire. We know, we all know this. Okay, so now they have to demonstrate, they have to protest, and they have to be more vigilant. Okay, and not get lost in very in fake debates, as it was the case in the previous elections. In fact, if you look at these last 10 years, in all elections, we had fake debates about immigration, headscarf. No, these are not the real issue. The real issue was retirement. What do you want for France as a nation? Okay. So, yeah, so this is one fact. It is very sad, but I think the first people to blame are the French people, the French, those who voted. They had the choice. They had the choice between Mélenchon. Okay, no, they did not vote for Mélenchon. Okay, so now they have to accept it.
So, Mr. Dabar, Mr. Taroy did mention that Macron is at a point now where he really doesn't have much to lose. This is something that we've heard from a lot of pundits over the past couple of days. But as you mentioned so yourself, Macron does have a lot to lose still. He has France to lose and, of course, the reputation of France as an advocate of democracy. So how do you think this will go down? How much do you agree with Mr. Taroy in order to wrap this up?
I would have a different focus. I think what we're seeing is the coming, growing irrelevance of the existing political structures to the lives of the people that live in France and elsewhere. And I think that what we're talking about here is a fundamental decision about allocation of resources inside the society, how much of it is going to be set aside for the people that produce the value, the working people. I don't think they have any more room to give in terms of not having anything to lose. We're talking about, for Macron, his political career. For most people in France, in Paris, they're identifying with it, for example. They're talking about the very survival. You know, this past winter, there was the question of whether or not to have fuel or food. If it's going to go up again another year or two, this and that, et cetera, things are going to get more intensive. You know, they become starker and starker choices. And there comes a point in time when the people decide that their own survival is more important than the forms of the existing government, and they toss it over. And the French have a tradition of doing that, and I think we're looking at the beginning of that now.
And do you agree with that, Mr. Taroy? A quick response.
I think that in terms of reputation, Macron does not care. And I think that this is the way the world goes. Now, if you look at every country, it's the same. Britain is the same. It is the decline of the West. This is what we have to admit. And there is a new order that is coming to life. This is what we see. So the American society, the British society, the French society, all the West is about to collapse. And we are in it right now, and we have to accept it. There is a new order coming. And things are going to be different.
Things are going to be different, and Mr. Dondebar also agrees, I assume. We don't have much time left. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen, Mustafa Taroré, academic and political commentator from Paris, and Mr. Dondebar, activist and commentator from New York. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and views on this edition of The Spotlight.
This is A to Z. An introduction to an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, refraining from anger in the month of Ramadan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's blessing and peace be upon Muhammad and his pure immaculate family. Hello, dear brothers and sisters. I'm Farhad, your host. You're listening to A to Z in Islamic Lifestyle, and we are here together to talk about moral conditions of acceptance of our praying, our worships, and our fasting, more specifically in this great month, month of Ramadan. We know this great month is the month of refraining, and the month of staying from sin, so we are here to practice how to stay from evilness in this great month. But for staying away evilness in this great month, we must know evil deeds. So for the beginning, we're going to talk about this sins, this evil deeds we probably will commit it in this great month. One of the severe evil deeds is anger. Anger is a psychological state that arises from inner excitement and the desire for revenge. So this is a simple description of anger. And when this feeling becomes more and more violent because of some conditions, it intensifies the fire of anger in our heart. And it causes the mind and our intellect to lose control and become powerless. So an angry person doesn't have any control on his mind and on his intellect. And these two strong power will turn to powerless. So, and it becomes a very severe condition and also dangerous. So in this state, a person can commit any act. Therefore, it is a dangerous situation. And the result will be disappointing and miserable. And sometimes the consequences will be irreparable. So we do an action, we commit an action, but we cannot correct it. And we will get in an everlasting evil action, and we can never get rid of that. So it's important to stay from such an action, such a situation, and such a great scene. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam says, in description of this word, in description of this situation, anger, he says, anger is the key that opens the door to all kinds of evil, to all kinds of vices. It is true that a man in anger has no control over himself, so he cannot protect himself from evil. Ramadan month is the best opportunity for us to practice controlling our anger, especially when we preserve with hunger and thirst. It sometimes happens when we are hungry, when we are thirsty, we can easily get angry. So this great month, Ramadan month, is the best opportunity for us to practicing this, to refraining from this bad manner. So if we try to control our anger, we'll gain the strength to control it even in difficult situations. So it's important to have this great point in our mind, and I hope we are all overcome this situation.
Ramadan al-mustabin jaa bin-nur al-mubin. Ramadan, Ramadan, Ramadan al-qanitin.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. I'm Farhad. You're listening to A to Z on Islamic Lifestyle. We were talking about anger, and we understood that anger is the key to all evil and vices. So we must control it, because when the fire of anger flares up, it burns everything down. But we must also learn to control it and cool down the fire of anger when it flares up. Therefore, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam says, whoever is angry with someone should sit down immediately when he stands. For that will turn the impurity of Satan away from him. And whoever is angry with a family member should approach him and touch him gently, for the feeling of belonging to the family, when stimulated by touch, leads to calming down. It's a very practical principle. We can easily control our anger by just doing this. And also Imam Ali says, alayhi salatu wasalam, he says, when a person becomes angry, if he's standing, he should get up immediately. So it means when we are angry, we have to change our situation. We have to change our position immediately to control our anger. So we see that by following these two divine principles, one can easily overcome anger and prevent its bad consequences in a very, very easy way. And I hope may Allah give us the strength of resisting evils and stay against evil in this great month. Thank you for being with us, and I wish you are all doing well in this great month, month of Ramadan.
Forgive me for everything I've done in the past, when everything was going so fast, and now I just can't go on.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir. Our email is english@irib.ir.
But I know that you are really loving, you are really caring. I can't realize, but you know that, that I will be better, that I will be stronger if you are by my side.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The margins were slim, the result momentous. Hamza Yousaf, a Muslim of Pakistani and Kenyan descent, becoming leader of the Scottish National Party after a bruising leadership campaign.
It is hard for me to find the words to describe just how honoured I am to be entrusted by our membership of the SNP to be the party's next leader and to be on the cusp of being our country's next First Minister.
The party he leads has a slim majority in the Scottish Parliament and has been working in coalition with the Progressive Green Party, for whom Yousaf, who has pledged continuity with his Liberal predecessor Nicola Sturgeon's era, is perhaps the right successor, compared to Economy Minister Kate Forbes, whose campaign got off to a rocky start over her socially conservative views.
I think there'd be a sigh of relief because I think if Kate Forbes, who got a far higher vote than was expected, but if Kate Forbes had won, then the Greens were not, had said they were not going to serve under her. So there's a sigh of relief that the coalition will continue.
The new First Minister faces major challenges, though. Record high National Health Service waiting times under him as Health Minister. Nicola Sturgeon's education promises yet to be fulfilled, and the UK government's blocking of a cross-party act of the Scottish Parliament on gender self-ID, which exposed deep divisions within the SNP, plus the issue of Scottish independence.
As First Minister, Hamza Yousaf has promised to lead for all in a country of 5.5 million. Yet despite the country being stuck around 50-50 on the question of independence from the UK and of Westminster, he has pledged to make it happen.
The last unsuccessful independence referendum was held in 2014, and the most recent attempt at holding a second one without the consent of Westminster was struck down by the UK's Supreme Court.
a lot of independent supporters, not just SNP members, feel frustrated. There have been constant promises, yes, there'll be a referendum, constant promises of a big campaign which never materialised. People are becoming frustrated. And I think Hamza, as First Minister, is going to have to address that.
Outgoing First Minister Nicola Sturgeon tendered her resignation to the UK King on Tuesday. It remains to be seen if her successor will make her the last one. Saeed Bourza, London.
A vigil has been held in Gaza to condemn the spike in Israeli violations of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the West Bank. Over the past few days, and with the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, dozens of Israeli forces stormed the vicinity of the compound of Al-Aqsa Mosque. They assaulted and placated Muslim worshippers and forced them out of the holy site, paving the way for Israeli far-right extremists to enter the mosque. That prompted Palestinians and resistance factions to reiterate their readiness to defend Al-Aqsa and repeat the 2021 Operation Sword Al-Quds if the Al-Aqsa status quo is violated.
The Palestinian used to just look at the situation in the West Bank and Al-Aqsa Mosque. These violations crossed the red line and the Palestinian people began to lose their patience. The Palestinian resistance has something to say if the occupation regime crosses our red line.
Palestinians and Muslims reject the temporal and spatial division of the Al-Aqsa Mosque between Muslims and Jews. This is while Israel keeps violating the internationally agreed status quo of the mosque. Ramadan every year witnesses Israeli attacks against Palestinians gathered in the holy place. In 2021, the expulsion of Palestinian families from their homes in Al-Quds and the Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy month of Ramadan led to an 11-day incursion on Gaza. More than 260 Palestinians were killed during the assault, including 67 children and 41 women. Over 2,000 Palestinians were injured and many more internally displaced.
Our message to the Israeli occupation is that breaching the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque puts Israel on the verge of a collapse. Because our people will never remain silent over these violations, nor will they accept the temporal division of Al-Aqsa.
A surge in Israeli settler violence and military raids on Palestinian towns have claimed the lives of more than 90 Palestinians since the start of this year. That makes 2023 the deadliest year in decades in the occupied East Al-Quds and the West Bank.
We in Gaza are telling you that you can count on us. We support you in each and every step of operation you take against the Israeli occupation regime. We salute your struggle and reiterate our steadfastness toward our land. We will never leave our land.
There are concerns that tensions in the occupied territories would escalate as Israeli forces and settlers continue their attacks on Palestinians and violate their sanctities in clear defiance of calls to stop the violence.
The repeated Israeli attacks against the Palestinians in the West Bank and the regime's flagrant violations of the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque during the fasting month of Ramadan have been met with strong condemnations here in Gaza, where people express their unwavering support for Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The United Nations headquarters in Geneva once again played host to the annual Human Rights Council session on Monday, where the UN Special Rapporteur to Iran released a report on women's rights situation inside the Islamic Republic. Predictably, his views sparked major dispute with Iran's delegation over accusations of mistreatment of women in recent months following Western-backed anti-Iran riots.
Advocacy for human rights is increasingly mistaken by some states and human rights mandate holders for their unwarranted and egotistic purposes, abusing the human rights mechanisms to single out and target those nations with independent foreign policy is void of any added value for protection of human rights.
As the envoys battled it out, two Iranian onlookers had a very real story of abuse, which had been largely ignored until now. Manager Safiyari and Elham Jalizavi, two Iranian nationals who suffered horrifically following terrorist attacks on Iranian soil. The culprits, notorious anti-Iran terrorist group the MKO, an obscure cult organization which currently receives significant Western support and even maintains a presence at the UN itself via NGOs.
By providing them asylum, Western countries violated the 1951 convention, enabling them to carry on all their human rights violations, which has, in turn, led to our rights being violated.
Safiyari was left wheelchair-bound at 17 after an MKO bomb attack targeted a market in 1985. Jalazavi was just 15 when her father was killed in their home by an MKO mortar attack in 1991. These are just two examples of the countless Iranian victims of MKO aggression. With the help of a sympathetic non-governmental organization, the Association for Defending Victims of Terrorism, their calls for justice have now reached the heart of the UN.
The MKO are a cult who commit these acts. Their members have been duped into cooperating with them. They've also been brainwashed. Their families, too, have suffered as a result. They, too, have fallen victim to the MKO.
They should be tried in court, not allowed to come here and claim innocence. We have even filed a lawsuit with French courts because many members live in France, but unfortunately the courts voted in their favour.
Despite past recognition of the MKO as terrorist organisation in the Western world, the US and its allies have performed a U-turn, now promoting them as legitimate opposition to the Islamic Republic, despite their many crimes against Iranian civilians.
The relationship between the Islamic Republic and the United Nations have gone through strained times, but it seems as if the UN is seemingly happy to continue providing a platform for anti-Iran terrorist organizations such as this. And as long as they do, it'll be hard to believe that ordinary Iranians will ever be able to fully trust this international institution. Robert Carter, Geneva.
Quranic verses and anti-Israeli and U.S. slogans rank high in this year's National Day of Resilience demonstration in the capital Sana'a, where protesters celebrated what they called 9 years of successful resistance against the Saudi-led war, which began back in March 26, 2015. Yemen's Supreme Political Council leader, Mohammed Ali al-Houthi, who was present at the demonstration, said the armed resistance against all enemies of Yemen will continue until every inch of Yemeni land is liberated from foreign presence.
We must protect our resistance effort and continue to counter this enemy. We must march forward together and confront this enemy. We must focus more on the battlefront and prepare for it now more than ever before. We must support our Ministry of Defense, which is equipped with men who have the hearts of lions, men who will teach the enemy a lesson they will never forget.
When Saudi Arabia launched its war back in 2015, it said it would destroy all heavy weapons possessed by Ansar Allah and force them to withdraw from the Yemeni capital. What has happened, however, is quite the opposite. The Ansar Allah movement has managed to win the battle across the board, developing sophisticated weapons and taking over more territory. They've also managed to win the hearts and minds of the majority of the people in the north.
We have been at war for 9 years, and we will continue to go to war for another 90 years if we must. We will never surrender, no matter how much they bomb. Our faith is in Allah, and it will never be shaken.
We came out in this huge protest to send a message to the Saudi-led coalition that we will remain resilient and we will never betray our cause, even if they add another 9 years to the previous 9 years of war. With our military of believers in Allah, we are coming for you. We are coming with our ballistic missile.
According to Mohammed Ali al-Houthi, if the Saudi-led coalition continues its war on Yemen, they will only witness greater losses and a bigger humiliation.
The war that was only supposed to last a few weeks has entered its ninth year. What's even more surprising is that the Yemeni army is stronger now than ever before. That's because they have developed long-range ballistic missiles and drones, which could be used if the war continues. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
A sentiment echoed by other anti-apartheid campaigners here, among them the International Center of Justice for Palestinians, who have called on the British government to refer Israel and Netanyahu to the International Court of Justice for war crimes in Palestine.
The protesters here are saying that the UK government's welcoming of Netanyahu is a mark of approval of his right-wing government, that it provides the Israeli regime with further cover to steal more Palestinian territory and to continue with its campaign of ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people.
Earlier this week, the UK and Israel signed a so-called 2030 roadmap for UK-Israel relations, strengthening bilateral ties with a regime whose finance minister denies the existence of a Palestinian people.
This is an extreme right-wing government itself. So this is, you know, one proto-fascist government supporting a proper fascist government. So I don't feel that this government is ever representing me on other issues as well. But that they are supporting such an excessive, extreme right-wing government in Israel is a shame for all of us.
But while all eyes are on the intensified Israeli violence against Palestinians, others are highlighting another important reason that's dragged an embattled Netanyahu to Europe. His trip comes in the wake of the recent Chinese-brokered rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Netanyahu could be here to gauge European government's position on Iran. From London, the Israeli PM will be flying to Berlin, Germany, where he is expected to be greeted with similar protests. Saeed Pourreza, London. A day after a surprise jump in inflation, an expected rise in the Bank of England's interest rate from 4% to 4.25, the 11th increase in less than 2 years.
The Bank of England argues the increase in the interest rate is aimed at reducing inflation that's amongst the highest levels since 1982. On the other hand, there are some economists who are saying it'll inevitably increase the pressure on many Britons, already being squeezed by the cost of living crisis.
That's because a higher interest rate means a higher cost of borrowing.
It's going to affect people with mortgages, and it's going to affect companies with debt, and there's a lot of companies with a lot of debt.
Today's interest hike comes against the backdrop of this pledge by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak in January.
We will halve inflation this year to ease the cost of living and give people financial security.
That is yet to happen. Some economists say some of the inflation rise can be blamed on potentially one-off factors, such as vegetable shortages caused by extreme weather in Spain and North Africa, and British producers not producing for fear of massive energy bills. Others say there are other underlying reasons. The Bank of England was the first to increase interest rates, but not the only one. EU and US central banks have also raised borrowing costs, with the American Central Bank's chair, Jerome Powell, saying there was still a long way to go to tame inflation in the world's largest economy. While Britons continue to contend with the soaring cost of food and energy, would this be the last rate hike by the UK's central bank? Saeed Pourreza, London.
Turkey's pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party and its allies have announced that they will not field a candidate to run against President Erdogan on May 14. HDP co-chairwoman Pervin Buldan made the announcement in a presser for the Labour and the Freedom Alliance, which includes the HDP, the Turkish Workers' Party and other leftist parties. Although it was not made clear during the conference, the announcement means the HDP will support the opposition National Alliance candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu.
We will fulfill our historical responsibility against the one-man rule. We are determined to hold this government, which continues a rule based on poverty and corruption. The HDP and its allies will not nominate a candidate for May 14.
The announcement is considered a major setback for Turkish President Erdogan, as the HDP is the third largest party in parliament. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan slammed the opposition bloc's cooperation with the pro-PKK People's Democratic Party, saying alliances should focus on common principles rather than negotiations over seats.
The announcement by the Kurdish alliance that they will not nominate a candidate will make this election difficult for President Erdogan, which means that the Kurdish votes will go to Kılıçdaroğlu. Yesterday, we also heard President Erdogan say that 17 of his ministers and his deputy will run for parliamentary elections to strengthen his party's position in these elections. Erdogan knows his position is not the strongest after the Kurdish alliance announcement and is trying to fix things around him to make sure he wins.
On Tuesday, the day before the announcement, Kılıçdaroğlu met with HDP leadership in the parliament building in Ankara, during which he made promises to remove restrictions on the Kurdish language and address other related issues. The May 14 election looks to be a tough one for the ruling party and its allies. Many say Kurdish voters could play the role of a kingmaker and help the opposition win this time. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Destination following his re-election.
This is in line with historical logic because we are each other's largest neighboring powers. We are also all-round strategic partners.
This is the 40th meeting between Putin and Xi during their presidency, which indicates the high and close level of cooperation between China and Russia for a long time. President Xi arrived in Moscow on March 20 for a three-day visit. He began his visit with an informal meeting with Vladimir Putin, which lasted almost 5 hours. On Tuesday, the head of state held an official meeting at the Grand Kremlin Palace. The priority in relations between Russia and China is trade and economic cooperation. In the documents signed by the two leaders, they vowed to multiply the volume of trade. It is expected that the Russian Federation and China will exceed the historical record trade volume of $200 billion this year. On February 24th, on the anniversary of the start of the Russian military operation in Ukraine, the Chinese Foreign Ministry presented a 12-point plan to resolve the conflict in Ukraine.
We believe that many of the provisions of the peace plan put forward by China are consonant with Russian approaches and can be taken as the basis for a peaceful settlement when they are ready for it in the West and in Kiev. However, so far we have not observed such readiness on their part.
China and Russia, as permanent members of the UN Security Council, also vowed to uphold the fundamental norms of international relations and build up constructive force for the formation of a multipolar world.
As for sending military equipment and weapons, military cooperation, China is unlikely to take drastic steps. First of all, China acts based on its own interests, not forgetting that relations with the Western world do not become bad. Otherwise, China itself faces sanctions. Its main trading partners are still in the West.
Putin and Xi Jinping also signed two joint documents setting long-term goals until 2030 across all tracks, a statement on plans for economic cooperation and a statement on plans to deepen partnership.
The Chinese president's three-day visit to Russia demonstrates the close historical relations between Beijing and Moscow. Any agreement made during Xi's trip can be regarded as a milestone given the fact that a new world order is being shaped. Marina Kartonova, Moscow.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to IRB English Radio. Thank you very much for joining us in a new episode of the House of Truth, Back to Reality. Well, I am Asma. I have the privilege to be your host. And here with me, I have Brother Hassanain from India and Sister Zainab from India as well. Well, I'm so happy to have you here both. Would you please introduce yourself very much briefly?
Assalamu alaikum. I am Zainab Askari from Indian Administrative Kashmir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamu alaikum, sisters. And salamu alaikum, everyone listening to the IRIB English Radio. I'm Hassanain from India.
So, welcome, both of you. In every single one of our lives, there are too much of experiences, too much of examples that we see wrong deed coming from the people we have trusted. And then, as we get older, we come to understand that we shouldn't, you know, I don't want to say that we shouldn't give a second chance to people who have hurt us, but let's just say we shouldn't trust someone who has hurt us once.
because there is a big chance they would do that again and again. So now I would ask you this question. Would you give the one who has hurted you a second chance?
It is hard to trust in him again. Like, once you lose trust in someone, it's really hard to, you know, gain it back, yeah.
Yeah, and you, sister?
Well, I am different over here. I would look at the circumstances, why the person betrayed me.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes in those circumstances, this has happened to me.
Is there any circumstances that I was the reason she betrayed me?
I was the reason. I feel like sometimes I got betrayed, but I feel like I was the reason. Sometimes you become so sensitive towards things and you show that obsession to others, they can't breathe.
Actually. And you suffocate them. You mean you suffocate the other people around?
You suffocate them yourself with your obsession. Mm-hmm. For example, I'm talking in terms of like you're attached to someone.
Yeah.
And then you're so sensitive as well and you're obsessed towards that person. But that person does not like obsession. That person wants to be free. And then if you're not letting that free space, if you're suffocating someone with your obsession, I am forcing that person to go and find someone else who does let you live your life freely, who does not suffocate you. And then I feel like I was betrayed. I was betrayed because of myself. So it always depends on situations. I'm not saying it's always you are the reason you get betrayed. But I analyzed the thing. I got betrayed. Why I got betrayed? What was the reason? Where did the things go wrong? Was something lacking in her education, his education?
Mm-hmm.
Was something lacking in his knowledge?
So you trust them again?
Not very easily. But I won't say that I don't give a second chance.
Mm-hmm. Giving these sort of people who hurt us a second chance is usually very much difficult. And I always wonder, is there anyone who gets any good from giving these people a second chance? And then I remember the sinners, you know? Mm-hmm. We always do that to our God. He always trusts us again and again and again and again. He gives us too much of chances, and still we do that betrayal again and again. And then I say to myself, okay, if the story is like this, you have to at least look at that as an example and learn it from him and give people a second chance and maybe a third chance, because we all are human beings, right?
You know, first of all, talking about trust, I really have a different opinion related to regarding this topic.
Yeah.
Trusting people. We need to be really careful who we are trusting. There's no guarantee. And as I've mentioned, you know, it's hard for us to, you know, trust again in the so-and-so person. You know, of course, like when we have analyzed the situation, when we have seen all the perspectives, all the circumstances, and we reached the conclusion that we really got betrayed.
Yeah.
Then it's hard for us to trust again.
It's finished.
Yeah, it's finished. And but still, it depends. Like, if it was a close friend, if it was someone from your family, you know, if there was someone close, there's still some chances that you might trust in them again.
Yeah.
But if it was someone, you know, not really close,
and you just know them for a year or a month.
Sometimes this thing also happens that I feel like I am betrayed, but I'm actually not betrayed. It's I feel like that. But the other person, the other party, you feel like this person has betrayed me, has not actually betrayed you. He feels like he has not betrayed you. I remember a case where
there might be some misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you see it from their perspective.
Yeah, chances.
Yeah, you might feel that you're betrayed, but you're actually not.
You don't know the whole story.
Yeah, and I was saying, but, you know, I completely have a different opinion about trusting. Is that, you know, trusting many times might lead you to disappointments.
Exactly.
When your trust is broken, this might disappoint you. There's a hadith. It's a hadith al-Qudsi, actually. It's from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You know, when I read this hadith, my opinion completely changed. In the hadith, what I remember from the hadith is, like, he says, وَعِزَّتِي وَجَلَالِي. Like, by my almightiness and my majesty. Like, whoever puts their trust in someone other than me, I will make them hopeless.
Yeah.
Whoever puts their hope in someone rather than me, I'll make them hopeless. Mm-hmm. Allah is saying this.
Indeed, yeah.
Because they have to come, at the end of the day, they have to come to this conclusion that the only one you can trust is Allah.
It's Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yeah, because
and unfortunately, we betray Allah.
Yeah, Allah. Unfortunately, we do that as well. So I can hear the break is tolling right now. So let's go for a short break and then we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
This is IRB English Radio, Back to Reality. We are talking about trust and betrayal and the thing that happens in life maybe every single day. It doesn't have to be so massive. Sometimes in small things also make us feel like we shouldn't trust people. We shouldn't feel so much of trust toward these strangers who mm-hmm. come into our lives. And yet, as human beings, we have to have trust in others, right? Because I guess that's the way we...